thank you.
It's really great to be back here with all of you. I don't know if Father's here yet, but I greet the priests who are here. And very much of an honor for me. I think everybody's probably, probably thought about this. I know we've been talking a lot about it. This AI thing that's happening in the world right now, especially when it comes to the question that we're coming into Holy Week now, the question that Pilate asks, Jesus, what is truth? And don't you sort of feel now that that's a question that we're all facing in a number of ways? What is truth? Who's telling the truth? Who's lying? And it's very strange now that we don't even know if we can trust our eyes and ears anymore. I mean, you really can. I'm sure some of you have gotten burned by AI ads. It's been very real. I mean, we all have. It's only going to get worse. And so I think meetings like this become really important. And we talk a lot about United Clans, and I think that might be a downside of what the plan is. And of course, there's the big plan that they have going, trying to figure out who they are, and what the big plan is, what the conspiracy is something. We spend a lot of time trying to figure out what they're doing. But maybe one thing that they didn't anticipate, we just came out of COVID with the lockdowns and the lies that went on during that, maybe one thing they didn't anticipate, and they're not anticipating right now, is that the internet is going to be a place that people don't trust if they're not careful, especially with video. So maybe we're going to get to the point where it's going to begin sort of feasting on itself, this beast, and it's going to force us to get together and to have humanity. I mean, that's really, they started with their war on God, and now there's a war on humanity, isn't there, going on. And it may be that we're all going to be forced to take our humanity more seriously and sacrifice not only for God, not only for what we believe, but sacrifice to put ourselves in situations like this, like tonight, where we get to look into each other's eyes again. We can have a little something to eat, have a little something to drink in the real world. I'm beginning to think that this kind of event is becoming one of the few places left where you can find the real world, reality, because everything else is fake. Everything else is deception. Everything else is artificial. So I really appreciate the opportunity to come here. And I appreciate the chance to kind of talk about what I believe, what we as traditional Catholics, what we're actually all about without the filters and without the lies and the fake news. But I want to start by saying happy first Friday to all of you. In fact, I have present. I don't have very many, which is a horrible thing to say. But I do have a number of these Sacred Heart lapel pins that I'm always happy to hand out if someone doesn't have one. I'm wearing one right now. The Sacred Heart of Jesus, which all the great counter-revolutionary movements of history, the Vendée in France, the Cristeros in Mexico, Carlos in Spain, they always dedicated themselves to the Sacred Heart of Jesus, and we are proud to do that. So the Remnant has started the International League of the Sacred Heart. Nothing to it. I don't need your email. I don't need your money. I don't need anything from you other than a commitment to take one of these Sacred Heart lapel pins and put it on your lapel or on your scarf, ladies, and wear it proudly. That's it. Nothing else. There's no commitment whatsoever. And there are hundreds of thousands of these now all around the world of people who have joined this League of the Sacred Heart of Jesus. So I want to start by inviting you. I've got about 10 or 15 in my pocket. I think anybody that would like one, please see me afterwards. I'll be happy to give you one. And to that end, I guess, I know there's been a little controversy. What are we as traditional Catholics? Are we really, is it first and foremost our thing to just be really super smart and really holy and better than other people and show people up and shout our opinions of someone else's sins publicly? No, it's really not, friends. I'm talking about in the hierarchy. Is this what defines us? Our courage to say it like it is? No. What defines traditional Catholics, or what should define all of us, is the love of our faith. We love our faith, we love the church, we love truth. And I always say to people, we're not going anywhere. When we talk about the fact that there's a crisis in our church, well, there's a crisis in religion throughout the whole world. You can see war being waged on all religion, but especially Christianity, especially Christ, especially Jesus Christ the King. The social teaching of Christ the King is under attack everywhere right now. And we're going to touch on that a little bit tonight. But we are the simple little people. And so we don't want to be seen as aggressive and horrible and arrogant. What we are is we're the little people who are demanding to know the truth. What must we believe? What must we do to save our souls? Because it's all over the map right now. No one's in the hierarchy seems terribly interested in getting us the specifics anymore. I went to Catholic school. We knew exactly what we had to do. The nuns told us exactly what we had to do to save our souls. It was pretty easy. And from the Baltimore Catechism, it boiled down to know, love, and serve God so that you could be happy with Him forever in the next world, right? That's what it was. That's what it is. That's what we're looking for. So it is not arrogance that drives us to ask tough questions. It is not arrogance that makes us say, well, this pope said this, and now this one says that, and there seems to be a contradiction here. We want nothing more in this world than to find ourselves in the embrace of Holy Mother Church. That's what we think about every day. The restoration of the church, defending the church. I covered the conclave, covered several conclaves now. And I remember the one when Pope Benedict XVI, when Joseph Ratzinger was named Pope. And I'm not even saying he was a traditionalist, but he had the faith. And we knew he had the faith. And I was in the Piazza of St. Peter's when they announced, and I want to tell you, friends, I've said this before because it's one of those moments, defining moments as a Catholic. Yes, we ask tough questions, but all we ever want is to disappear as traditionalists. We just want to simply to live our faith, raise our children, save our souls, right? And so when Joseph Ratzinger, it was such a surprise when he was named, and I'm standing in the piazza, and we hear it echo across the piazza, and now the conciliazione, Joseph, 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 Ratzinger, 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 Ratzinger. And the place just erupted, and I'm German, and I found myself dancing in the street and crying my eyes out because I thought we had a chance now. I thought I could disappear as a so-called traditional Catholic, and I could just go home and raise my kids because that's all we want. That's what defines us. That's what Unite the Clans is all about. People who come together, like we're doing tonight, and we say we still believe. We look at each other and we say we still believe. I want to talk about the martyrs at the end because martyrdom is becoming more real every day. But while I'm thinking of it now, I like to say to people, when you think about all the martyrs in history, when you think about what they did at the very end, I'm talking about Agnes, Barbara, Tarsicius, starting back then, moving all the way up to modern times, maybe a Father Michael Pro, for example. What does he do? Let's use Pro as an example. You all know who he is, one of the great Cristero priests who did so much to defend the kingship of Jesus Christ. And he was quite active, so he would go around dressed as a layman. He would be in disguises. In other words, he did everything he possibly could not to be martyred, but to continue to minister to the flock, like an Edmund Campion did. And so many people were afraid, as we are afraid today. So many people, so many Mexican Catholics were terrified by what was going to happen. Because what had they seen? They had seen their brothers and their mothers and their sisters and their friends hanging from telegraph poles by the neck. The revolution was killing them. They were scared. They were terrified. Many of them were worried that they would apostatize. And so if you take an example like Father Michael Pro, what does he do at the very end? What is this beautiful gift that he gives his flock right before he dies? As the rifles are raised and they're preparing to shoot, he extends his arms and he says, Viva Cristo Rey! Do you know why? So he could make one last sermon. Not only to his little flock then, but to us, all the way down through Hinton and through time, one last sermon, the revolution failed. Everything they're doing today is to try to get us to apostatize, to abandon Christ. And these great martyrs like Michael Pro, no, they didn't get me. I still believe. Bam, 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 down he goes. The last thing he said was, the revolution failed. and we're still telling a story. So that's the kind of thing when we talk about martyrdom, we talk about the sacrifices that have to be made. Those are the models for us. And so we have this moment in time now where we do have to ask difficult questions. Nothing is clear. I just came back from a few months ago from the Synod on Synodality, covering that in the Vatican Press Office. And I'll tell you, friends, I don't mean to run anybody down. In fact, the Vatican Press officials are very kind to us. And I think the reason they're kind is because they want us to get the word out. There's a serious crisis going on, right? Journalists from all over the world are asking very tough questions about what's happening. What is truth? What does the Catholic Church teach anymore? And the answer had been that the Catholic Church, at this point, is involved with something called synodality. Synodality. What is synodality? Over and over and over again, journalists ask that question, what is synodality? And that's the big answer that the Vatican has come up with. The problem is it doesn't make any sense. The even bigger problem than that is synodality was condemned by Pope Paul VI. See, this is what I'm talking about when we have to ask these questions. We're not the ones stirring up the hornet's nest. We're not the ones who are the rebels here. We are the confused sheep. We are the ones who want to know what we must do to save our souls. So I'll read this just briefly. Remember, all we hear about is synodality, synodality, synodality now. That is going to save the church. What is it? Listening? They say they're going to listen to us? I see many people here are as old as I am or older. The church was listening to us when we were 7 years old. The church taught us how to go to confession. There was a little green light in that box, in the confessional box, over the confessional box. Every single time we went to confession, the church, Mother Church, was listening to us. The problem is now they decided they don't want to listen to Christ. They don't want to listen to the traditional church teaching. And they tell us things like synodality is so important, as if they don't know that Pope Paul VI, now this is not a traditionalist, Pope Paul VI, he's the one that gave us the new Mass. Paul VI's speech at the College of Cardinals in June 1972, June 23rd, of the Acta Apostolica Sedis, number 64, page 498 and 499, for those of you who are taking notes. And I'll just read a little bit to give you a sample, not the whole thing. Pope Paul VI, talking about what he calls synodalism, which is the first original synodality, says, one cannot fail to see that this situation with synodality, produces a very painful and unfortunately dangerous effects for the church, confusion and suffering of consciences, religious impoverishment, painful defections in the field of consecrated life, and of the fidelity and indissolubility of marriage, weakening of ecumenism, insufficiency of moral barriers against the eruptive hedonism of the day. So is it our fault that we're confused by synodality when we get from Pope Francis, when just his predecessor said, stay away from it. It's dangerous. Just teach the faith. Similarly, we take a lot of criticism because we're concerned about the Second Vatican Council, not the document so much. That's not what I'm talking about at the moment, but rather the event. The event. What is Vatican II? What's happened since Vatican II? And I'm not one of these who wants to sit around and blame Vatican II all day long. It ended before I was born. But it was a seminal event. It's a watershed moment. And I would argue that it has not been a success. And you would say, oh my gosh, how can you say that? Who do you think you are? Are you more Catholic than the Pope? That used to be a joke. But I'll cite you another pope. Pope Benedict XVI, in his last speech to the curia in Rome, gave a talk about the Second Vatican Council. And he said, the council had been co-opted by the media. You can look this up. I encourage you to do so. It had been, he calls it the council of the media. And he says, because the council was taken over by the media, I'm not saying if I agree or disagree with what His Holiness said. I'm just telling you what he said. Because it was taken over by the media, no one has ever been able to get to the true teachings of Vatican II, he said, about 10 years ago. And he said, the council that everyone in the world received was packaged and given to them by the media. And he said that council caused so much destruction. It caused the seminaries to close, the religious life to die out, the liturgy to be banalized, trivialized, said Pope Benedict XVI. And he explains how we never actually got to see the council as it was supposed to be. We were given this fake and artificial one through the media. So where does that leave you and I? Where does it leave us? Which council are we supposedly rejecting when they say, you reject Vatican II? We don't reject Vatican II. In fact, traditional Catholics accept more of Vatican II than a lot of radical, progressive Catholic priests and bishops today. Anything in Vatican II that is a reiteration of the previous and defying teachings of the Church, we accept on pain of mortal sin, right? But so Benedict XVI says, you never really got the council yet. This is what I'm talking about, the confusion that leaves us as faithful Catholics, people who are trying to be faithful. It leaves us in confusion, in the dark. And so we ask questions. And it doesn't do any good for them to say, don't ask questions. That's why so many people have left the Church. So this talk tonight is about this idea of toleration, tolerance. Because it seems to be, in the name of tolerance, we're watching our Catholic identity simply disappear. And this is, as I'm going to say in a minute, this is a sign of Antichrist. That Christ the King, that the teaching of Jesus Christ is fading away the way that it is now. In the name of tolerance. So, you tell me, it used to be, even when I was still a kid in Catholic school, the bishops, the priests, the nuns, certainly, it was their job to tell us what we must do, as I just said, to save our souls. Somewhere along the line, there's been an inversion. And so many priests, bishops, so many lay people spend all their time talking about what people don't need to do. They don't need to become Catholics. They don't need to accept Jesus Christ. They don't need to be baptized. Right? That's the big switch. It used to be, this is what you must do to save your soul. Now everybody's saying, no, you don't have to do this. Everybody, basically, everybody's going to heaven. All good people are going to heaven, whether you're Catholic or not. Now you can argue, the Church teaches that outside, extra ecclesia domiciles, outside the Church there is no salvation. You can say, boy, that seems harsh. But that's the defined teaching of the Church. Is anyone aware of any bishop in the Church right now who believes that there's no salvation outside the Catholic Church or who preaches that? Now, I'm not trying to be critical of the bishops. I'm trying to say this is why we have a defection, the mass apostasy that even Pope John Paul was talking about. Because nobody knows what to believe anymore. And this is inherently of the devil. I'm not ascribing evil, satanic motives to anyone. I'm just trying to explain this is where we are now. Absolute lack of clarity. Confusion. It's Lent. How many people in this... I would imagine at one time these little towns here were primarily Catholic. And majority or a healthy minority were Catholic. How many people even know what they're supposed to do on Friday in Lent? Do they even know? Even all year round, we are supposed to be giving up meat on Friday still. And if we can't do meat, well, we have the option of something else, God knows what. I mean, it was never defined. But now you get to the point where nobody knows. So Cardinal Dolan came out the other day and he said, our Muslim brothers, Ramadan starts tomorrow, they're giving up, they're sacrificing, they're putting us to shame, said Cardinal Dolan. And he's right. But why are they putting us to shame? Because we don't know what we believe anymore.
There's just, the clear teaching is simply going away. And this goes back a long way, so I'm gonna just briefly touch on a couple of points that have to do with kind of where this all started. And it started in the Garden of Eden, of course. It's been going for a long, long, long time. That's one of the things that traditional Catholics have to be very careful of. The issues that we face today, the crisis that we face today, goes much further. It's much older than Vatican II. It was coming for a long time. But at Vatican II, there was a shift. And we changed the way we spoke about the doctrines of the faith, and people became very unclear as to what we believe. So it would behoove us to look into one of the documents, especially on Vatican II, that set this on this course. And that document is Nostra Aetate. Nostra Aetate had to do with the Church's relationship with non-Christian religions, especially the Jewish religion. And what they did was they decided that because in deference to the Jewish folks who were saying, we don't want to be seen as dialogue, we want to be seen as dialogue partners, we don't want to be seen as people who you're trying to convert anymore. We want to be seen as people who share in the mission to make the brotherhood of man, make the world a better place. And so Nostra Aetate as a document, this is not an infallible document of Vatican II, by the way, no one ever claimed that it was. But Nostra Aetate then, under the leadership of Cardinal Bea, became the document that now basically says the Catholic Church is not necessary for salvation when it comes to the Jewish people. And I'm not going to go into all the details of that. But that's an example of how the Church decided, I'm going to kind of sort of raise the flag, the white flag of surrender a little bit. We're not going to say that it's necessary to convert anymore. We're going to try to sort of get along with people and be softer and gentler and so forth. Well, the result of that was pretty simple. When people started putting it together, Catholics started putting it together, that Jewish people do not have to become Catholics. The Catholic Church isn't interested at all in converting them. They're still the chosen people. Then you can get to heaven without reliance on Jesus Christ or his church. And from that movement in the church, in the Second Vatican Council, it began to evolve to include all Christian religions, whether they're Catholic or not, all denominations of Christianity, quote-unquote. And so now we have arrived at a point where even many, many traditional Catholics are really hesitant to say you have to become a Catholic in order to be saved. All Protestants are probably going to be saved. It's not necessary for us to preach salvation or the necessity of converting to the Catholic Church. And this, I think, is really an identity crisis such as the Catholic Church has never experienced before. Because again, we're so eager to tell people that they don't have to join the Catholic Church, that it's not necessary, that we're not intolerant, that we are tolerant, we are the religion of toleration, that we end up without an identity. And the interesting thing about that, according to Cardinal Newman, is that de facto apostasy, that toleration, is actually the anti-Christian result. He sees it as an anti-Christ, as a precursor to the Antichrist. This is through the great Cardinal Newman, who's been canonized now. And so he writes, and I'll read this briefly. After, of course, Pope Pius XI, in Mortalium Animos, had condemned pan-religious gatherings as inherently contra-Christian, against the Catholic teaching of the Church, Cardinal Newman, before that, had already been talking about how this idea that all Christian denominations, basically that all religions lead to God, lead to heaven, is a sign of the Antichrist. And he writes, Cardinal Newman, the Church of God on earth will be greatly reduced in the times of Antichrist. That's happening today. He says, this desertion will begin in a professed indifference to any particular form of Christianity. That's happening today. Under the pretense of universal toleration, which will proceed from a design to undermine Christianity by multiplying and encouraging the different sects of Christians. Now here's the interesting part for our topic tonight. The soft apostasy of toleration. Cardinal Newman says, from the toleration of the most pestilent heresies the world government will proceed to a positive persecution of the truth of Christianity. And that, friends, is happening all over the world. If Christianity doesn't mean anything, if we have no one who will stand up for Christ, the secular governments of the world have no reason not to crush Christianity. The Antichrist himself will rise up out of an indifference that it just doesn't matter anymore. And you have to be charitable, don't get me wrong. My grandfather was a Lutheran, died a Lutheran. And I like to think that God, on some level, that's between my grandfather and God when he died. What happened to my grandfather? I'm not talking about becoming, trying to condemn everybody. That's not the point. The point is, we need to talk about what we need to do to save our souls. What do we need to tell people? What do we need to say to people? And God tells us, Jesus tells us what we must do for that. He said, go out and convert all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. That's the only thing we know. That's what Jesus said we're supposed to do. The Church of Jesus Christ for 1,965 years taught that outside the Catholic Church there is no salvation. It is not up for us. It's not up to us to talk about the exceptions or to stress the exceptions. We look at our friends who are Protestant. We look at our friends who are Jewish. We have friends who are not Catholic. And we lovingly say, this is what we believe. And that's what I mean about formally adhering to traditional Catholicism. This is the most charitable thing that we can do. It's either true what we believe or it's not. If we believe it's true, then we have to become lights in this incredible stifling darkness in the world today, not by preaching condemnation at everybody, but by living the Christ-like faith, by extending those arms like Father Michael Pro and saying, Viva Cristo Rey. Christ is King. Christ rules. Pope Pius XI, the great Pope Pius XI, when he promulgated the feast of Christ the King, do you know when he did this? He did this in the 1927, I believe. But in any case, right between World War I and World War II, the entire world is at war. And the Pope comes out and he does not say we must dialogue more. He said the only way for the Pax Christi, the only way for peace in the world, is through the social reign of Jesus Christ. And it must be proclaimed, he said, not just by individuals, but by nations, friends. And that's why I started at the top of this talk. It's so important as us unite the clans. What are we doing? We're trying to make sure that we keep the faith. Because what they want, what the revolution wants more than anything else, is for us to become afraid or to become unsure. This is what the Antichrist is saying, to the extent anti-Christians are saying. Don't worry about being rigid, doctrinally rigid. Be kind, be tolerant. That's what you have to do. That's the face of Jesus. This is not the Jesus Christ who founded the church and hung from a cross and rose from the dead, an actual historic figure who lived and died and said he was God. This is not what he did, what he said. He came down to this earth. He established a church. He shed his blood for us. And he said there's one way of salvation. And that's through the church which he founded. And that's all we know, friends. That's all we know. We have to live that faith. I know it sounds, duh. But it's not duh anymore. Because everywhere we look, they're saying it doesn't matter. God is dead. Somebody has to keep the faith, and that's up to us, and we're going to do it in small communities. The lay people, as Bishop Fulton Sheen said, the lay people must save the church, says the great Fulton Sheen. And what's he mean by that? We're going to become the most eloquent speakers in the world. We're going to start military counter-revolutions. No. He means we're the ones that are going to keep the faith. We are going to keep the faith. And we're going to die for it if we must. And that's the message of love. Everywhere you look. I put a video up today of these poor little children at a heavy metal, I don't even know how to describe this music concert, but the point is that little kids were 6, 7 years old, and the music is pulsating black death metal. that they're at this concert for, and these little kids are doing their little satanic salute, and there's hundreds of them in this concert. And I'm thinking, no wonder there's such diabolical disorientation. No wonder. This is what we're doing to our kids. And you know what? By the time they're 15, 18, 20 years old, they've lost their way. They don't know what they're doing. They start taking drugs. They become suicidal. Why? Because they don't have Christ. They don't have anybody who will say to them, here's the truth. Let me show you the truth. The peace of Jesus Christ, the Pax Christi, as Pius XI called it. And we just have to get back to that, friends. To with honor and dignity. This is the thing we've been saying over and over again. Yes, it's a duty to keep the faith. Yes, it is. But think of it in a different way. Think of it. All the powers on earth are lining up right now to crush Jesus Christ, the Church of Jesus Christ. They've infiltrated our church. They're trying to destroy it. They think they've won, and they have not. And for whatever reason, friends, there are people like us in this room tonight, and there are millions of us in pockets all around the world who've kept the faith. Don't you think that's just about the greatest honor in your life? Don't you think that's what we should be saying to our children? Don't look at it just the duty to keep the faith. Look at it as the greatest honor of your life to have this chance, just one chance, to keep the faith. They'll tell our story someday. We're telling the story of the Vendée right now, the Vendée in France. 500,000 of them were killed before they would stop believing in the Catholic faith. The Cristeros, how many hundreds of thousands of Cristeros murdered, slaughtered? Catholics under the Nazis, Catholics under the socialists who kept the faith. We're telling their story. If we can just convey this to our young people, to our grandkids, that this is the greatest honor of our lives, that's the thing, I think, that will inspire them to keep going and to stand up against this anti-Christian spirit in the world today. And that's exactly what it is, friends. So I want to close with a quote and take some questions if you want, if you'd like to. It's a quote from Fulton Sheen. This is 1947. I can barely believe how prescient this is, how prophetic it is. But then again, the traditional Catholics of that time period, they all knew it wasn't just the Mass. They knew they were fighting against a one-world order, a one-world religion. The destruction of the Catholic Church had to come first. The mystical body of Christ had to be destroyed first, had to be crucified first. Christendom had to be destroyed. And after that would come the Antichrist. Literally, Christ would be taken down, Antichrist would follow. So Fulton Sheen, of course, knew that was coming as well. That's what happens when you pull Christ out of society, as they've been trying to do. You have what Hilaire Belloc called the chaos, Christless chaos. And that's what we're living through now. And Fulton Sheen, 1947, says, the Antichrist will come disguised as a great humanitarian. It will speak of peace, prosperity, and abundance, not as a means to lead us to God, but as the goals themselves. He will be so free-spirited that he will identify tolerance with indifference to right and wrong, truth and error. He will promote science. He will invoke religion, but to destroy religion. He will even speak of Christ, that he was a great man, the greatest man who ever lived, perhaps, a philosopher, great philosopher, which is happening all around us now. He will give us opinions, not truths, commentators, not teachers, surveys, not principles, nature, not grace. And for that golden calf, this is the important part, for all these things that he's going to give us, he's going to save our day. He will save our country. He will give us technocracy. He will give us transhumanism. He will let us live forever, perhaps. And the promise of that, coupled with the defection and the apostasy in the Catholic Church, the Christian Church, the promise of that, according to Fulton Sheen, and for that golden calf, the people will break away from Christ. He will deceive even the chosen ones. This is perhaps one of the more terrifying things that we could contemplate right now. From the lips of Fulton Sheen, it makes it even worse, a man who I think was a saint. That the Antichrist is deceiving the world all of us. Our Lady of Fatima talked about, and Sister Lucia talked about diabolical disorientation, friends. We could be being diabolically deceived in this room right now, to some degree. She didn't say, well, there are a bunch of people who won't be diabolically deceived. Our Lord in Scripture does not say, well, there's going to be signs and wonders at the end, but there'll be a bunch of people who won't be deceived by that. It's going to be easy to see through the Antichrist. No, he doesn't say that. The fact that he's warning us about that, that Our Lady's warning us about diabolical disorientation, suggests that every single one of us in this room is susceptible. Is susceptible to that. And we have to put our heads together now and make sure we keep the faith. That's why the title of this talk, Tradition, is the answer. It's the only answer, friends. It's the only answer. It's the thing that survived for 2,000 years. It built mighty Christendom. And the thing is, if we're going to use our faith to save ourselves from the deception of Antichrist, it's not rocket science. It's penny catechism. It's clinging to tradition for dear life. It's closing your eyes and believing and not letting anyone rock you off of that. It's lying in your bed at night with your eyes closed and your rosary in your hand. That's how easy it is. If we have the courage and the guts and the faith and the love and the hope to keep the faith. That's what has to happen. It's not impossible. You're doing it tonight. We're working on it together. It's our project. All around the world. But now is the time, friends, to take it very, very seriously. Because the deception is everywhere. Maybe you know what I'm talking about, maybe you don't. But we're looking to people who deny the divinity of Jesus Christ, who deny every sacrament, who deny his church, who deny that he rose from the dead, who maybe think he didn't even live at all. They are our salvation right now. They're the ones who are going to save our country. I think we're being deceived right now. If we believe that there's going to be some great salvation for our country and for our world and for our church that leaves Jesus Christ out of it. Now's the time. Now's the time, right now, to make up our minds that we're going to keep the faith. Together. And I need you and you need me. I always say that, and I'll close on that. With all that and one more hopeful thing I want to share with you before I leave. I will die for my faith. Now that sounds like a pretty cocky thing to say. Remember Thomas More? This is not the stuff of which martyrs are made. Very healthy attitude. And I echo Thomas More. Because all of us, we just don't know what's going to happen when they come to... When they come to kill us, that's one thing. But what about when they put a knife to your child or your grandchild's throat and say, do you believe in Jesus Christ? That's where it gets pretty real. I always remember the story of this Rwandan mother during the troubles of Rwanda. And her little children are being killed right in front of her because they want to break her. They're slitting the throat of her little daughter. And this mother, this beautiful Catholic mother, bends over. She's tied back. She tries to get her daughter's eyes. And she says, oh my God, I am heartily sorry for having offended thee. I detest all my sins. She's doing the act of contrition with her daughter to make sure she goes to God. And that's the kind of thing we have to talk about. It's not pleasant, but that's what we have to talk about. Whether or not we have that faith and that kind of courage to do it. So I say, again, I will die for my faith. And here's the thing. This is why I'm saying it. Everywhere I go now, because I feel like it's getting bad out there. Christian persecution is on the rise everywhere in the world. And so I say it, not because I want you to think I'm a hero, but because I want you to hold me to it. I want as many people out in the world remembering that Michael Matt said he was going to die for his faith. So if it ever comes to that, I'll remember that I said it to you. There's a human impetus in that as well. We want to be saints. We want to do it for God. But we also want to do it for each other. If it comes down to that. And that could be a suffering of death. It could be persecution of losing jobs. Whatever it might be. We saw during COVID, persecution takes all sorts of different shapes. But the thing is, if we say we will keep the faith no matter what, and we say it loud enough, and we say it to each other, then we need to hold each other to it. I need your help. We all need each other's help. Making sure we stay confirmed in that. That we will not be deceived. that we will save each other as well in this dark, dark time. And that in the end, as we always say, in the end, the victory has already happened. God's already won. Our Lady says, in the end, my immaculate heart will triumph. Our Lord says, I will be with you always, even unto the consummation of the world. So we know what's going to happen. He wins, they win, we win if we stay with God. And I guess that's the point. When I say toleration, yes, love. We love people to Christ wherever we possibly can, but we don't tolerate evil. We don't pretend like it doesn't matter what Christian denomination you are, what religion you are. The saints and the martyrs went to their deaths defending the doctrines of our church. It does matter. And we will not make fools of the martyrs by saying, hey, it doesn't matter, man. Everybody's going to the happy place anyway. So I'll leave you with this. And if you want to have a little longer discussion, that's fine. Just a few thoughts I wanted to talk mostly about sticking together. Because that's one of the reasons I love to come out and meet with the clients for that reason. But I also want to give you just a little bit of good news. Maybe you already heard this, but you know, we do this Chartres pilgrimage in France every year, which is a 70-mile, 3-day, 2-night, sleep-on-the-ground pilgrimage. It goes back to the Middle Ages. Basically, it's the old route to Santiago de Compostela, but you go to Chartres because Our Lady's veil is there. That's the way it started in medieval times. You pilgrims, you walk all the way to Chartres, you couldn't go to the Holy Land, and you venerated the veil. It's still there, or actual veil. Crusaders would have gone on the way to the Holy Land. They would go to Chartres, and they would touch their tunic to the reliquary of Our Lady, that she would stand with them, and they would stand with her, and that she would protect them. I've done that. Put my coat to the little reliquary where Our Lady's veil is. I believe it's the most important thing happening in the world today, because it happens on an annual basis. It doesn't seem to be. There have been many forces that have tried to close it down. Last year, they had to close off registration at 20,000 young people. The average age is 20 years old. And there are people, pilgrims, young people, all over, and older people all around the world who are joining it virtually. It's a massive demonstration of faith, traditional Catholic faith, faith in the Latin Mass too, proclamation of the social kingdom of Jesus Christ. Okay, but here's the thing. Used to be, the traditional route, as I say, was Paris to Chartres. Used to be there was only one pilgrimage. There was a division in 1988, and there became two pilgrimages. One is run by the Society of St. Pius X, the other is run as diocesan curing St. Peter priest, Pleasure Day priest. That's the one I'm on. It's a traditional route. 25,000 people. Okay, so the relationship between the two organizations has always been good. Pius X, they even stop halfway sometimes and have a little drink together. It's not like it is in the States where everybody's at each other's throats. Now here's my good news for you, and then I'll shut up. We had hoped, we'd always started our pilgrimage in Paris at Notre Dame, the newly restored Notre Dame. I had a feeling when that building burned that Our Lady was going to protect it. And I wrote about this and I did videos about this. People said, no way, man, it's going to be a swimming pool and Starbucks. They're going to totally trash it. And I said, I don't think so. It's too important. Our Lady is going to protect that building. Sure enough, she did. The architect was a traditional Catholic. A lot of the young people, the craftsmen that worked on it, were traditional Catholic pilgrims from this pilgrimage, dedicating their work to Our Lady's cathedral, and then they're promising to walk the pilgrimage in her honor. And they told CNN this, and they told all the press, the media people of the world, that's what they were doing. The cathedral miraculously makes a comeback. There she is. It's still Novus Ordo, so got some problems liturgically because of the more liberal modernism. But the building is there, as it was. So we wanted to start at that place, to start again at Notre Dame in Paris, because we always have. Bishop says no. It's too new. You're too big. Can't do it. Just stay at Saint-Sulpice, which is the second largest church in Paris. We did. Okay. We'll try again next year. So we walked from Paris to Notre Dame in Chartres. Cathedral in Chartres. Great honor to be able to have Mass, Christian Latin Mass in Chartres. Yesterday, I found out the Society of St. Pius X pilgrimage, because they're a little bit smaller, went to the mayor of Paris and asked for permission to have their traditional Latin Mass. Remember, they go the other direction. So we crossed midway. They wanted to know if they could have their traditional Latin Mass at Notre Dame. The mayor said, well, I know it's a church thing, but if you want to use the huge square right out in front of Notre Dame, which is where all the tourists go, right at the back of the cathedral. For your mass, go right ahead. So now what do we have? Now we have this coming Pentecost. France, and remember, one more thing I'll say. Last year, the largest, like the Fox News of France, miraculously showed up at the Mass. I think it was Father Bishop Schneider who said the Mass. Maybe it was Cardinal Muller. Anyway, it's Cardinal Muller, I think. They showed up and filmed the entire traditional Latin Mass with 20,000 kids going to Mass on their knees, communing on their tongue, right? Broadcasting all across France for 2.5 hours. That's just unheard of. It's not done. So now what you have this year is you have upwards to 50,000 young pilgrims pretty much shutting down Paris and that route between Paris and Chartres over the entire Pentecost weekend. Pentecost being the great feast where the Holy Ghost descends upon the apostles, fills them with courage, sends them out to bring Christ to the world. That's going to happen. Two massive traditional public Latin masses in France, all very, very much on the up and up. There'll be media planes overhead. There'll be newspaper coverage constantly of this. And I bring you that because it doesn't matter what happens, friends. If you keep the faith, God's going to keep the faith as well. If you meet him halfway, this is what I believe. Meet him halfway, he'll show us the rest of the way. And that's the thing. Have faith. Don't let them discourage you. Because what happened? And I don't mean this to be critical of Pope Francis. I'm just saying Pope Francis has a different orientation liturgically. He doesn't believe the Latin Mass should be available throughout the church. But he sees this movement of it was supposed to be little old grannies, little old people like me going to the Latin Mass. Not young people. But we all saw during COVID, the church of Latin Masses were parked, just packed up with young families. And if they weren't allowed in the churches, they went out in the parking lots and sent a message to the whole world. Traditional Catholics are filled with love. We are consumed with love for our church. We are consumed with love for our mother. We will never, ever leave her. There's no place else to go. She's our church. She's our castle. It's where we stay. She's our mother. And wouldn't you know, God is rewarding that faith by these wonderful signs. Signs that he's still with us, just as he promised. I will be with you always, even to the consummation of the world. All we have to do is believe that. And then continue to live our faith, as we were taught when we were little children. Go to confession. Go to communion. Say your rosary. Keep the faith. We can do that. Most of us have spent a lifetime doing it. Successfully sometimes, it's not so much. We're working on it. We're getting there. And that's all we have to do. And that, my friends, as far as I'm concerned, is what traditional Catholicism is all about. Simply loving the church and loving the faith enough to keep both and defend them both in a world that hates them. That's it. Thank you for listening. I appreciate it. It's really super controversial, and so I want to unite the clans rather than divide. I was very supportive of the Trump phenomenon, especially 2016 to 2020, because I believed, not because I thought he was a daily communicant and he was perfect, but rather because he was willing to stand with us, and by us I mean the little people of the world, the pro-life movement of the world, in a very serious and earnest way. Do I think Donald Trump at that point was pro-life? I don't know. I think he was trying to figure out what it even meant, quite honestly. But he was willing to stand with us, and the whole world got to see him stand with the little people who believe, the people who I believe are closest to our Lord and to our Lady. And Trump was willing to do that. So I haven't given up on him, but I think that what happened the last time was there was a bit of a deception that you didn't need those little people anymore. You needed the big people. You needed the Silicon Valley folks. You need Peter Thiel. You need Elon Musk, all these people. To sort of sacrificing the little people, and more importantly, what he said about abortion and IVF and gay marriage were problematic. Now, I understand, he's a pragmatic guy. He's trying to get in. And now we're seeing things like, well, you know, defunded Planned Parenthood, that's, I think that rather than try to come up with a it's too soon to come up with a really clear piece of advice on what we should do. I think we should really pray for him. And I think we should, I don't mean that like in a throwaway, pray for the guy, that's sweet, but I mean, how about something practical? I think that if Donald Trump, he's the type of guy that if these Silicon Valley people and the Christian Zionists I'm very concerned about, if they become a political liability, I think he will back away from that. And so I think it's really important for us not to give up hope in the fight. We have to continue to say what we believe. No, we don't support abortion pills. We don't support IVF. We do not support gay marriage, you know? And there's a certain sense of betrayal there that we had to kind of be put on the back burner this time around. So I think it's important to recognize that that happened, to not pretend like it didn't happen, but then also to see the things that are happening that maybe we can work with that might be positive. All I would say is please don't close your eyes to what's going on. Elon Musk, I think he means well. But if you look at what he does, what he's talking about, it's not that different from Klaus Schwab, Davos, the Great Reset. He really does. And if anybody doesn't want, you know, that's a bitter pill to swallow. I have plenty of the clips where Musk is saying the same thing about, you know, these chips in the brain, all these things, the currency, the EVs, the surveillance cities, the surveillance cars, you know, automobiles. It's very similar. And now they're talking about things like, I think they call them Patriot cities, or Freedom cities, where they're going to be smart cities with smart cars. I just want you to just look into that stuff and to try to make sure that we're not being deceived again on that score either. And just to remember, again, don't project. I mean, I would say, in all humility, don't project onto Elon Musk and Donald Trump what isn't there. You know what I mean? They're not claiming to be Christians. They're not claiming to be champions of the social kingdom of Jesus Christ. So it's almost self-deceptive for us to say, I think that's what they're actually working towards. No, it's not. It's a very practical, we're going to use big money, and we're going to get rid of this woke stuff, which is terrible for business. DEI, the diversity, equity, and inclusion, terrible for business as a business model. And these guys are businessmen, so they want to get rid of that stuff, rightly so. And that overlaps with what we want, because we have moral reasons for wanting to get rid of that stuff, you know. So there's an overlap here and there, but I think it's much more important for us to be very intelligent about how we look at it, very charitable, pray for them, but don't make them into something that they're not. And then maybe we get to be like we were the first time around, where we really had a lot of influence on Donald Trump. I think it's possible to do that again. I don't support the wars that's going on. I want Donald Trump to come home and make America great again, not go around and do this war. He campaigned on that. So I think it's very important for us to speak up on that topic and to say to Donald Trump, hey, we didn't vote for this, so can we get back to basics? Practical stuff, but not, I don't think it's necessary at this point to condemn everything. Look for it. There are a lot of good things that are happening, and let's push for more and not back down at all on our principle, especially when it comes to life and marriage. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, I think it's important to, when God puts us in a certain place at a certain time, there's a reason. So I don't know if you remember what Thomas More said when he was asked to take the, St. Thomas More, when he was asked to take the oath of supremacy. He said, what are the words? What are the words? I might be able to take this. So he wasn't eager to become martyr. He wanted to stay and fight as much as he possibly could for the realm, for the king, for the pope. Something similar, I think, goes on with the voting process. Like, can I vote for this in conscience? If I can I make my country a better place for my children? Not the social kingdom of Jesus Christ being proclaimed. I don't live in a Catholic country. But is it possible for me to vote for this man who's going to facilitate my ability to love my country, raise my children, keep my faith, or woman, whoever the candidate is? And so I think that's the big conscience issue, since we have sold out on the Christian confessional state, we've beheaded the Catholic kings and queens of Europe, and now we're stuck with a very secular society. Thomas Jefferson, who wrote the Declaration of Independence, did not believe in the virgin birth, did not believe in the divinity of Jesus Christ, and did not believe in the resurrection. And he wrote our founding Declaration of Independence. These are difficult things to face. On the other hand, God wants us to fight in the world in which he put us. So if it's possible to engage the enemy or to engage the politicians, to drag them, I firmly believe that Donald Trump was influenced by Christian pro-lifers to come our direction, just like Christian Zionists now are pushing him in a different direction. So I think it is possible, and if it is possible, and if in conscience we can vote for someone without compromising our beliefs as Catholics, then I think it's necessary to stay engaged. If someone like yourself says, I don't want to vote, I can't do it in conscience, I think you should be left alone. I don't think anyone should say you're a coward or you want the other side to vote.
you're following your conscience. And I think that's one of those questions where it's really important to get our priests involved and to say, can we vote for this guy? You know, and if he comes right out and says, I want to kill babies, as many as I possibly can, like a Kamala Harris or something like that, or Joe Biden, well, it's easy. But if it's something in the middle, that's where we have to have very serious discussions. But we can't anathematize each other over this. This is what was so sad about the last one. Everybody was trying to follow their conscience. Don't condemn everybody. If you couldn't vote for Trump because he said, I accept the abortion pill, you weren't trying to get Kamala Harris voted. You were having a dilemma of conscience. And that's a very serious thing for people. So I would say one thing we can all do right away is end that. Stop. Declare a moratorium on mutual assured destruction with people who are trying to do the best they can. No, thanks. Thanks. That's a great question. My answer is a little bit different than what most people are saying. Most people say, man, it's just going to be worse. You know, what's the point? You stack the College of Cardinals. I don't like that attitude because that leaves out the grace of office. It leaves out the Holy Ghost. It leaves out a lot of things. I always say to people, for example, the Sistine Chapel, I was there a couple times when the Cardinals went inside and sealed that chapel. Why do they seal the chapel? Media can't go anywhere near that. Why is that? Because the church is trying to keep political intrigue and influence out of that process. But the fact that the church is always trying to keep that intrigue out means it's possible. It's not all just the Holy Ghost. You know, picking the Pope and that's it. You can't question it. No, that's not it at all. It's a human process trying to cooperate with the Holy Ghost. So I think many things have happened in the past. Pius IX, for example, the liberal who was supposed to, you know, comply with the liberals of his day, he does the Syllabus of Errors, one of the most powerful condemnations of errors that the church has ever come up with in modern times. Anyway, nobody expected that. Everybody thought Leo XIII was going to die very soon. He ended up having one of the longest reigns and doing so much incredible, powerful work. So we just don't know. But I think on the human level, and I've been, as I say, I covered the synod, I'm in the Vatican Press Office a lot, enough to know that I think the Vatican Press Office even likes the fact that there are traditional Catholics who are trying to get some influence going. So what do I think is going to happen? Of course, you can't say. It's all very, very difficult. But where I think I depart a little bit with other people is I think maybe what's happening now with Francis has made it so it's not going to be that popular to become Francis II. And if you wanted to talk about something that might, a positive sign of it, there are positive things to think about what the Trump effect has been. The Trump effect, that by that I mean nationalism, you know, borders guys that want to at least say something about Jesus Christ, they're considered very conservative in Europe, that is going to have, in my opinion, an effect, an impact on the conclave. So when those cardinals get together, are they going to say, let's make this even more radical, let's get even more synodality in here, or are they going to say, hey, if we don't watch it, the church is going to just be destroyed. It's going to be over. There's not a lot of glory left in being a modernist church. Nobody really cares that much what the bishops and the cardinals are saying. It's really kind of shrinking and disappearing. And I would add to that that we have this thing called the Catholic Identity Conference out in Pittsburgh. We do it every year. It's got like 800 people in the chairs and another few thousand around the world. Okay, do you know that this year, I think we're breaking this for the first time. Oh, I got a story here. This year, in October, in Pittsburgh, we are going to have four bishops and one former Anglican bishop who's now converted. Four bishops. Now, I'm not talking about bishops of some society. I'm talking about mainstream Catholic bishops who've simply had enough to the extent that they're willing to come and talk to us at a conference that's considered very traditional Catholic. So I look at things like that and I say, bishops at the CIC, whoever would have thought that was coming? We had Cardinal Muller speak at the CIC 2 years ago. Now, this was the head of the CDF. This is the second most powerful guy in the church under Benedict. And he comes and speaks at a traditional Catholic conference. All of these things added up. What Cardinal Burke is doing, what Bishop Schneider is doing, all these names are familiar or not to you. But bishops who are speaking out, to me suggests the next conference could be very different than what we think. Because there is a sort of a fatigue with this radical sort of always on the edge of revolution and pushing the synodality thing further and further and further. And I think a lot of bishops, I wouldn't be surprised to find that a lot of bishops are saying it's time for a change. And again, that Trump effect is influencing politics. Why would it not influence to some degree the politics of the church? You know, that the future is this pendulum is swinging back a little bit, in other words. So that's certainly what I hope and pray for. I've never given up on the church. I don't think you could ever look at a conclave and say that, well, the Holy Ghost can't do anything to save. God is going to save his church. God is going to save his church. It's not for us to save the church. It's the church that saves us. So we, as I say, we hang on to tradition. We keep the faith. The mother church still saves us. God saves it in his time. It's just our job to witness. That's all it is, you know, for that great restoration of the Catholic Church that I absolutely believe is coming. And I'll say one more thing. When I was a kid, I've been traditional Catholic all my life. Traditional Latin masses for me, I learned to serve the traditional Latin mass in the basement of my childhood home. We actually went and rescued an altar and stuck it down by the pool table, and it was very awkward when friends came over and all this stuff. But these priests came from all over the world. That's where I learned to serve the mass. Now, do you think I ever thought in a million years a day was coming when I would walk into the Basilica of St. Peter's in Rome and see traditional Latin masses at all the side altars like used to happen all the time under Benedict XVI, or that the Shark Cathedral would be packed out with 20,000 young people for this most magnificent traditional Latin mass? In other words, if you had given up on it, if you'd been in the 1970s and said, this is stupid, God doesn't exist, nothing good's ever going to happen. Now you can't even believe the good things that have happened. The fact that we're here like this and there's conferences like this, even a lot bigger ones all around the world, to me says that we can never, ever, ever give up on it. Just do our little part, God will do the rest. I hope that doesn't sound like Pollyanna, but to me that's how I think of it. Yeah. I'm kind of doing it myself, I guess, at least as far as I understand it. I shoot my own food and plant my own food and do all that crazy stuff, but I grew up in the suburbs. I didn't grow up like that. But I think that getting back to the land and getting back to less reliance on the system is really smart. We all saw that during COVID. I mean, that was just insane what was going on. And I remember, I don't know if this is directly related to your question, but I remember Gretchen Whitmer, that Witless Wonder over in Michigan, banned garden seeds. She banned seeds during COVID, which to me was like, oh my gosh, this is what they're actually thinking. They want to deprive us of our ability to survive all this. So I think it's really important. I think that also, like, I homeschool my kids. I've got seven. Well, I shouldn't say I do. I'm just the guy that gets called in when everything goes down to get any given afternoon. But my wife and I, we homeschool our kids, and I think all of this, and what you're talking about is more formal, and I get that, the actual commitment to it, but anything that goes in that direction, in terms of what the family can do, it's really healthy. I think it's really good to be with your children, to teach them those basic skills, survival skills, to go back to the land, kind of get away from the city, and I think you can, if you think about, I don't know if you ever do any reading of what Bill Gates has planned for everyone, and the stack farming that they want to have in the city, and the fact that they would like to declare all the rural areas green spaces that are, it's a violation to live there because you're hurting Mother Earth or whatever. They seem to be very concerned about that idea of self-reliance and moving in back to the land and learning these skills and going back to do all that. I mean, the skills are as old as human nature, I mean, as human beings, so it's not difficult. I think it just requires a commitment to see that how important that is to not be dependent on the system that's unhealthy for your body, that's unhealthy for your soul. It's like the public school system. I don't know how it is in this state, but our public school system is absolutely insane. Well, you guys know Governor Walz, a lovely governor. You know, he just came out a few days ago, they made a law saying that if your car is on a public highway, the interior of your car is considered a public space. People can come in whenever they want. Where that's going to go, I don't know. But in any case, my point is, to your question, I think I totally support that. I completely support the homeschool movement. As far as I'm concerned, the homeschool mothers in this country, literally front line. They are the front line because they're out there going to war every single day to make sure those little souls, you know, the Jesuits used to say, give me a child until he's 7 years old and he will be God's for life. I want those first formative years. Well, these homeschool moms, as far as I'm concerned, and if you're grandparents now and you can't teach anymore, you can just be—you know how it is—be so supportive of the mothers who are working hard. The fathers really working hard to do the homeschooling. It's not easy, but they are the front line, and they are going to—I think—they're going to raise the Agneses and the Tarsisius and the Barbaras, the little saints from which mighty Christendom grew. It's going to come out of that homeschool movement to do a homeschooling situation. I think to maximize it, it's important to be in the country, to have land that you can plant and teach all about how God
intends that to be used as well. So I don't know if that helps, but I totally support, to the extent that I understand the background movement, I support it. I just what comes to mind quickly would be with my father was what I was trying to convey tonight. I consider myself standing on the shoulders of giants with these traditionalists, and I'm just trying to remember what I learned from hanging out underneath the piano bench and listening to them all talk. You know, I try to implement that. You know, so but one thing I think that surprises people is the great sense of humor these guys had. I mean, they had gallows humor. They were in this thing to win it. They gave up everything. I mean, all of them. My father was. When he left his newspaper, The Wanderer, he had seven children. I was the baby. He had no income whatsoever. He just walked out the door because of what was happening with Vatican II and the new mass. He said, I gotta go fight this. Put his faith completely in God, and it's just a miracle that worked out. And he was just ridiculed. You can imagine, this is 1967. Everything is cool. It's like Woodstock is coming, and it's rock and roll, and the Beatles and Rolling Stones, and you know, what was happening with the church that tied the guitars, and everything was so progressive, supposedly forward-looking. And these traditionalists just said, no, something's wrong here. But because of that, they were really mocked. And I guess I would say, it sounds really weird, sorry, Dad, because to stress his sense of humor, but I think it's really important to remember their prayer life was really strong. They weren't trying to God-bother everybody or virtue signal all the time. They were simply trying to do what I said tonight. Just the faith was handed to them to my father from his father, and he was just trying to hand it down. That's what he thought was his duty. And he thought he had an obligation to do that with a smile and that, you know, we're going to do this, we got this together, and to keep a sense of humor and to not take yourself too seriously. I think that was a big part of what Michael Davies and my father, a lot of these guys, don't take yourself too seriously. Just do the thing. Just do the thing. Keep the faith. That's it. Archbishop Lefebvre, I knew him only because he confirmed me when I was 10 years old. It seemed to me I was in the presence of a saint, but then again, at that age, a lot of people seem that way. A humility that was you know, well documented. He literally gave his life for the church, and I can tell you, having lived through that period, I know a lot of people say, "Aren't they a schism?" And I can tell you that he was head of the Holy Ghost Fathers. He was one of the greatest missionaries Africa has ever seen, right? And he gave up everything for the church that meant everything to him. He died in disgrace. He gets excommunicated. He never wanted to break with Rome. You can read this in his page. The poor man, when you can see him talking in some of the videos that exist where his face is almost in tears. He's so destroyed by what's happening to the church. So I would only say, from what I remember as a child about some of these men, is that the lack of arrogance was profound. The lack of any intention of leaving the church or starting their own or counting themselves popes absolutely didn't exist. They were in the middle of a crisis. They kept the faith, and for some of them, who were higher profile, they lost everything for it. They suffered a great deal. In my book, that's a hero. So I have a great deal of admiration. Doesn't mean I agree with everything, but that's a hero, and one that I hope I would be proud to emulate in some way. I'd like to carry on their work as long as I possibly can. So that's where I come down. Yes, sir. Yeah, it's basically when I said that we had the little altar in the basement. Those guys would have been the early canceled priests. One of the ones that I remember very clearly had been a seminary professor at Laval. The man was Jewish, converted to Catholicism. I had the Summa Theologica, I think, memorized. He spoke eight languages. He was a brilliant theologian, Thomistic theologian. And because he didn't go along with the liturgical revolution, he said to his bishop, "I'm not going to say the new mass. I'm going to say the old mass, but I won't do it publicly." The bishop said, "Okay, you can do that privately. You can still be under my jurisdiction, but you can't just defy me." So he spent the rest of his priestly life, like another whatever it would have been, 30 years, lived to be a very old man, living as more or less like a canceled priest. And it was very, very difficult for him. And that's what I meant about the different kind of martyr. Like, he suffered a great deal of a dry martyrdom for his faith. So I think with the canceled priests, there are a lot of them out there, and a lot of really good ones. And I think it's just a question of prudence on our part. Like, talk to them, get to know them, because there's some of them, like the one I just described, these men are like saints, and they're really good, and they don't want to leave the church. They don't want to, again, probably make themselves bishops or somehow start another church. And then there are others who try to graft onto the canceled priest movement, not the capital C. I mean, just they want to become, and I've run into them before. And I'll give you an example of how that works. One of them, I'm not going to name him, but he came up to me, and I knew him quite well, and he said, I want you to know that my order's coming after me. They're coming after me because I say the Latin Mass, and just be, they're going to say terrible things about me. And he set this thing up for a long time, right, for weeks with me, only to find out that one day he was arrested. He had been molesting young boys, and he was absolutely guilty as sin. And I remember just feeling so violated because I thought, oh, he's just a good guy. And he set me up for that by saying it's because he's so good that they're saying terrible things. So I would only, this has happened to me at least 5 times that I know personally where it's happened to me. My only recommendation would be, let's, as a community, embrace and support canceled priests when it's absolutely unjust and they're completely on the up and up. And this is not that difficult to find out. But be wary. Don't fall for every single, there's a lot of bad people in the world, lay people and priests. So don't fall for every single priest that comes along and tells you he's being persecuted because he's such a traditionalist. Because that is, and I hate to see our movement that we've tried to defend all of our lives used and abused like that. And that's literally what it is when that happens. So that's the only thing I would say. I think it's important to support them. I think that the ones that I really, really gravitate towards and appreciate are the ones that say we're staying in the church and we're going to suffer with our Lord. I love that. I love that because that's what we all have to do. Versus, I'm going to go start my own thing, and it's going to be my church now, and I'll be the Pope, and my mom will be, and Dad will be the conclave or something. I decide it makes me crazy. So, I think it's just a matter of prudence, and then the ones who are taking that tough stand should be hailed, and I think supported for what they're doing. So, like a Bishop Strickland, I mean, he's such a good and holy man. He didn't want to start his own church. I just saw him a couple weekends ago. He's not starting his own church. He's not becoming a cardinal or anything else. He's just suffering for the bride of Christ, suffering for the church. And he was punished for speaking out. Well, I certainly am proud to stand next to that. That would be a canceled bishop. I'm very proud to stand next to people like that, priests and bishops like that, and lay people who do the same, you know, in the name of the church. So hope that helps. That's where I'm at. Well, you know, that's a case-by-case thing, and I can only tell you that wherever I go and whatever I do interviews, I ask people who are in authority on that. Excuse me. So, for example, I asked Bishop Schneider about that, Athanasius Schneider, who, again, I think is one of the holiest prelates or priests or bishops in the church today, and he would not agree. He wouldn't want me saying that, but that's between us. That's what I think. And I asked him, what should they do? Like, what should if the mass gets shut down, what should a priest do? And he said, first of all, for lay people, you got to be ready to drive. So we got to drive. In his opinion, you have to drive an hour, 2 hours, whatever, to get to the mass, especially if you have children. He did not believe that you should stop going to Latin mass. He thinks you should just sacrifice more if it's at all possible. For the priest, he said, this is all on video, so I'm not speaking out of turn here. He said they need to find a bishop, the priests need to find a bishop who will allow them to say the Latin Mass. And I said, well, Excellency, that's easier said than done. You know, so how would it? And he said, well, even the Society of St. Pius X bishops, if that's the only way you can continue to say the Mass, and try to get in touch with a priest or a bishop of the Society of St. Pius X, because a priest needs to have some structure. So now he wasn't saying run out and do that, but he was saying in worst case scenario, even if the priest was being told he had to stop saying the Latin Mass, then he should explore all those options. That's where I think it's very tricky, it's very difficult, because the hierarchy of the church is such, it's established by Jesus Christ. We don't get to just blow it off. The restoration of the church is not, although the lay people will keep the faith, I believe that fidelity is going to be acknowledged. I absolutely believe this. Going to be acknowledged from on high, from the hierarchy. The hierarchy must be protected and defended even when it's a time like it is now, because ultimately the salvation of the church, the restoration of the church comes through the hierarchy. So we can't adopt a cavalier attitude. We don't care about the bishop. We don't care about the pope. We're going to do whatever we want. We got to stay in there and continue to fight. And that's really, really difficult. I get it. There's all sorts of different ways of doing that. People disagree with that. But that should be plan A. How do we make sure you never, ever break from the church? So if a bishop says you must, like in our case, the bishop said you can't have a Latin Mass in a parish church. So we were one of the ones that went and got turned it into an oratory, which is what it is now. And the archbishop says, fine, that's great. It doesn't make any sense. It's the same building. But we had to kind of let him say how he was going to not shut it down, the conditions that he was going to give that wouldn't shut it down. So I think it's a situation for everybody to go case by case. I know that maybe that sounds like I'm weaseling out of it, but I really think it's very important that we really appreciate and understand the importance of not leaving the church, no matter what. No matter what. Yes, sir. I remember I went to Christendom College. That's where I graduated college years ago. And Father Vincent Bocelli was out there. He wasn't allowed to say Mass. This is before Summorum Pontificum, of course. Before Ecclesia Dei, actually. He wasn't allowed to, who knows after. But anyway, he wasn't allowed to say Mass on campus at Christendom at that time. So he just said private Masses. And all that meant was you can't advertise it. That's what a private Mass is. Everybody can know it's there. It's not like you're hiding from the police or something. Everybody, 1,000 people can know it's there. It's not an advertised Mass. And a bunch of us would just go to that Mass. So I see private Masses. I don't know if Father's here. I don't know. I mean, the priests especially are the ones that have to that we need to go to and talk to about this, because they're the ones whose heads on the chopping blocks. You know what I mean? Like, it's easy for us to say, come on, Father, be a man. Just, you know, defy the bishop. Well, maybe not. That's easy for me to say. I'm not a priest. So, and I also think that there have been examples of really good and holy priests who have worked their way into, you know, they may comply at first and then work their way back around. I also say historically, this is probably going to get me in trouble. Historically, you had during the French Revolution, during the Bombay Uprising, you had juring and non-juring priests. Some of those juring priests, in other words, they took an oath of fidelity to the government in Paris, and that was, from the church's point of view, this was the wrong thing to do. But some of them did it simply because they had 300 families that they wanted to take care of. So they had this massive conscience issue. They didn't see it as apostasy. They saw it as accommodating their need to take care of their flocks. So I would say, I mean, that's an extreme case. I'm not saying I even agree with that. I'm just saying that was the reality. I would be careful about saying every Novus Ordo priest who says a new Mass is the devil incarnate. I think there's a lot of really good Novus Ordo priests who are in a weird situation where they want to make their Mass more traditional. They want to come in the way of tradition, and in fact they are. And ultimately they'll find the Latin Mass. And it's all about direction. Like, if you know good priests who are really with you, and they're taught, like, man, I'm going to do everything I possibly can. I want to do no more communion of the hand. I don't want altar girls. And they're coming in the direction of tradition. I think we as traditional Catholics should open our arms wide and encourage that rather than condemning them because they're not saying the Latin Mass yet. So I think there's a whole lot. Your question is actually really loaded. There's a whole lot of things to think about with respect to that question. And the main thing, as far as I'm concerned, is to continue with conversations like this and to try to find out what God's will is. And just, as I say, number one concern for me, stay in the church at all costs. Anyone else? Good.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks for coming. Thanks so much.